The topic that's been assigned to me in this study is institutionalism, and it has been said that a proposition clearly defined is halfway proven. And believing that to be true, in the very beginning, I want to give a definition of what I mean by institutionalism. Institutionalism is the establishment of other institutions supported by a church or churches to accomplish work. And it is the instituting of a middleman organization. Please remember that. A middleman organization between the local congregation and its work. And so the issue comes down to this. Do the scriptures authorize a middleman organization, or is the church, and specifically I'm talking about the local congregation, as we're going to get into in a moment, is the church all sufficient to do the work that God assigned it to do? Now, actually, this topic involves several issues that must be taken into consideration, and that's why I believe it's necessary for me to, first of all, lay some groundwork before we go any further. And so I want to remind you now of some foundational truths that you should already know. First of all, let me remind you that when we're talking about the church is a divine institution. Because after all, it was established by the Lord and not according to the will of man. In Matthew 16 and verse 18, Jesus made the promise. He said that upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So we understand the church is a divine institution, and that, of course, is why we should see the need of following the divine pattern as revealed in God's Word, because the Lord set up His church exactly as He wanted it to be. And since the church is a divine organization, that means that it possesses certain characteristics that no human organization possesses. And so that leads me to my next point. And that is, secondly, the church has been given a divine mission to accomplish the purposes of God for which it was designed. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, there Paul talks about the house of God, which is the church of the living God, and he says that it is the pillar and the ground of the truth. And that, of course, involves the idea that the church has been given the responsibility of supporting and proclaiming the truth. And furthermore, God has ordained that we are to serve and to glorify Him in the church. For we read in Ephesians 3 and verse 21, "Unto Him be glory in the church by Jesus Christ throughout all ages, world without end." I think sometimes people have it all backwards. Sometimes people reason like this. They say, where would the church be today without its benevolent societies and educational institutions? And they say that's why we need to get behind them, because where would the church be without these things? Well, let me say, first of all, that the church would be right where the Lord put it. And I think that's the answer to the question. The Lord would be, or the church would be, exactly where the Lord put it. And surely no one will deny that the early church of the first century grew and prospered, and yet they accomplished the work of the church without institutionalism. In other words, they never built benevolent societies or educational institutions. In fact, they never contributed out of their treasuries to such. And the truth is, they never heard of such. But nonetheless, they fulfilled the divine mission of the church, and they preached the gospel to the known world at that time, as Paul indicated in Colossians 1 and verse 23. And so you see, in order for one to defend institutionalism, they must rest their case upon the sum total of absolutely no scripture. Because we don't read of such in regard to the New Testament church in the Word of God. But also let me say that if the church is a divine institution with a divine mission to fulfill, do we really believe that it takes a human organization to help the church do its work? And think about this. Who is really dependent upon whom? That's why I said a moment ago that some people have it all backwards. Is it the case that the church cannot do its work without those institutions? Or is it actually the case that those human institutions are being propped up by the church, needing its money and support? And I think the answer to those questions should be obvious. And so here's the point. The church, being the divine institution that it is all sufficient to do the work that God assigned it to do. And those who defend institutionalism, they will deny it, but here is a great error that it involves. It denies the principle of the all-sufficiency of the church to do its work and to accomplish its mission. And so then now, I want to pose the question, how does the church function and how does the church carry all of this out? Well, that leads me now to my next point. Because thirdly, and this is very important to understand, the local congregation is the only organization that God has given the New Testament church through which it is to operate and function. Simply put, there is no organization in the Lord's church larger than, smaller than, or other than the local congregation. And I wonder this evening, are there some people who maybe are offended by that? Are there people who are offended by that because maybe that almost sounds too simple or too mundane to accept? Well, that may be the case. But when you study about the organization of the church, I think this is one thing that stands out in the New Testament, and that is its simplicity. And instead of being insulted by that and wanting to change that, I think really we need to see the beauty and we need to see the wisdom of it. Yes, the structure of Christ's church is rather simple and uncomplicated, especially when compared to the man-made machinery of great ecclesiastical groups. But I want to say that this divine plan has no equal, and it allows the church to efficiently and sufficiently accomplish her God-given mission. And remember this, when men dare to change the organization of the church, it always results in apostasy. Now that's the truth. We can see that, of course, in history. When men change the organization that God has given his church, it always results in apostasy. And furthermore, it is something that robs Christ of the preeminence that he is to have in all things pertaining to the church. As Paul wrote in Colossians 1:18, he emphasizes that Jesus is the head, the spiritual head of his spiritual body, the church. That means he rules over his church and he governs all things pertaining to his church. And in all things, Paul says, in the church, he is to have the preeminence. Now surely, we are all aware, and I'm going to touch on this for just a few moments, that the term church is used in two senses in the Bible. And I'm going to cover this because I think we have to understand this in order to put this particular topic into perspective. The term church, as used in the Bible, is used in at least two senses. First of all, it is sometimes used in a universal sense. And of course, when we talk about the church in its universal sense, we're talking about the one body that all of the saved are added to. Now, the one body, the universal church, you see, is composed of individuals. In other words, it is composed of all of those who have been saved throughout the world through their obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Remember, Paul tells us in Ephesians 4 and verse 4, there's one body. How many bodies are there? One, the Apostle Paul tells us. And he had already informed the Ephesians in the first chapter and verses 22 and 23 that the church is the body. The body is the church. So if there's one body and the body is the church, then obviously he is telling us that there is but one church. Now Jesus was without doubt referring to the church in his universal sense when again in Matthew 16 and verse 18, he said that upon this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Notice he talks about his church in the singular. And he uses the singular pronoun, it. He says, I am going to build my church. What's he talking about here? He's talking about that one church, or that one body, if you please, that he's going to build, that all the saved are going to be added to. And incidentally, the church, in its universal sense, only denotes a spiritual relationship. In other words, it does not involve an organization of any kind. The New Testament is completely silent as to any organization through which the universal church could function. And I believe this right here is an important principle for us to understand. Now listen, if the Lord had intended for the church universal to function in any way, surely he would have provided the organizational structure through which that could have been possible. If he wanted the church universal to function, he would have given the church universal some kind of an organization through which it could have done that. But he didn't. There is no organization in regard to the church universal. And so you see, any effort that activates the church universal, either wittingly or unwittingly, involves an unscriptural practice. And that's the reason why that it must be rejected. Because, and I want to hasten to add now, that secondly, sometimes the church is used in a local sense in the Scriptures. Now notice, sometimes it's used in a universal sense to refer to the one body that all the saved are added to. But at other times, it is used in a local sense. And when we talk about the church in a local sense, we're referring to local congregations. In other words, we're talking about local groups that are composed of the saved in a given locality. In Romans 16 and verse 16, Paul said, the churches. Now I want you to notice in this passage, he uses the term in the plural. He talks about the churches of Christ. He says, salute you. What's he talking about here? Well, he's referring to congregations, you see, at different localities. And in the New Testament, we read of these different congregations. For example, we read about the church of God at Corinth in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 2. We read of the churches of Galatia in Galatians 1 and verse 2. Galatia was a region or a province of Asia Minor. And there were congregations, you see, that existed in different localities of that province. We also read of the church of the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse 1. And remember, in the book of Revelation, we read about the seven churches of Asia that Jesus wrote letters to in Revelation 1 and verse 4. The seven churches of Asia, of course, were Ephesus and Sardis and Pergamos and so on. These were different congregations. Now, I want to emphasize that these were not different denominations as we see in the religious worlds today, but they were simply local congregations, and they were identical. They were identical in name, in doctrine, in worship, in organization, and so on. Now, I want to point this out, and I'm going to just kind of throw this in for free this evening. But you know, when you take into account that the term church is used in these two senses in the Bible, sometimes it's used in a universal sense. As we said, this refers to the one church, the one body that all the saved are added to. And sometimes the term church is used in a local sense to refer to local congregations, the saved in a given locality. And you take that into account. Now listen, it becomes obvious why that denominationalism is an unscriptural system. It becomes obvious why that denominationalism does not fit the pattern of the New Testament church. Why do I say that? I say that because when you stop to think about it, a denomination will not fit into either one of these two scriptural categories. In fact, a denomination is too small to be the church universal and is too large to be the church in a local sense. Why do I say that? Well, think about it. Is a particular denomination out here, is it the church in the universal sense? Why no? In fact, they themselves will admit that. I guess every denomination will say, well, you know, we're not saying that all of the saved are in our denomination. Obviously, there are people that are in other denominations that are saved. You don't have to be a member of our denomination in order to be saved. And so, a denomination is not the church in its universal sense. But then on the other hand, a denomination is not the church in its local sense. Because you see, denominations in and of themselves have different congregations, you see, different local groups that make up that particular denomination. So as I said, a denomination is too small to be the church in its universal sense, is too large to be the church in its local sense. And so the truth is, denominationalism is an unscriptural system. Denominationalism does not fit the pattern of the New Testament church. Now, let's put all of this in perspective. What have we been leading up to? What I'm leading up to is this. Now listen, the church, in its local sense, is the only organization that God has given the New Testament church. And we need to understand the church, in its local sense, is not only a relationship, but it is also an organic body, we might say. In other words, what I mean by that is, it is an organization. And since God has given the church only a local organization, the congregation, that is how He obviously intended for the church to function and to work. Now then, let me set forth some facts about the local church as found in the Word of God. I'm going to go through this because I think these are things that are necessary to understand if we're going to understand this particular topic that we're dealing with tonight. Here are some things that the Bible reveals about the local congregation. First of all, I would point out that in the Scriptures, local churches were spoken of as separate units. You know, Paul, for example, as we know, sent different epistles to different congregations, didn't he? He sent one epistle over to the Corinthians. He sent another epistle or letter to the church at Ephesus and one over to the church at Philippi and so on. And so obviously Paul was dealing with these congregations in that sense as separate units. Secondly, when Jesus wrote letters to the seven churches of Asia, of course, as found in the book of Revelation, He dealt with them as separate units, and He announced that He was familiar with the works and the thoughts of each congregation. And when you read those letters, it becomes obvious that each congregation had a set of circumstances that was all their own. You remember that of the churches, only two were commended without fault. That was Smyrna and Philadelphia. And only one received absolutely no praise at all from the Lord. And that, of course, was the church at Laodicea. Thirdly, and this is important, each local church, now listen, Each local church was made up of members. They had their own members. And when discipline became necessary, it was administered by the local church toward its own unfaithful members. That's what Paul is dealing with in 1 Corinthians 5 as he writes to the Corinthians. As we know, they had an immoral man in their midst. And what did Paul tell them to do? In 1 Corinthians 5 verse 13, he said, "Therefore, put away from among yourselves." Notice that. The church of Corinth was a local congregation. They had their own members. There was a man in their midst who needed to be disciplined, and they were to administer that discipline toward him. And Paul says, unless he repents, you put away from among yourselves that wicked person. But fourthly, not only did each congregation have its own members, but each congregation also had its own local leadership. As men met the qualifications, elders were ordained in every city. As we read in Titus 1 and verse 5, and in Acts 14 and verse 23, we read of them ordaining elders in every church. Please observe that each congregation had their own eldership. In other words, men who were ordained to take the oversight of the local church. That's who elders are. That's their responsibility. They're overseers. And they take the oversight of the affairs of that congregation. When Paul wrote to the church at Philippi, he not only greeted all the saints who were members of that congregation, but he also added the following. Listen to what he says in Philippians 1 verse 1. He says, "To all the saints in Christ Jesus which are at Philippi," now listen, "with the bishops and deacons." The word bishops there simply means overseers. In other words, he's talking about those men who were elders, who were the overseers of that congregation. And then Peter writes along these lines in 1 Peter 5 and verses 1 and 2. He says, "The elders which are among you, I exhort." And then he talks about their responsibility. He says, "Feed the flock of God," now listen, "which is among you, taking the oversight thereof." What are these elders to do? Well, they're local overseers. And so he says, your responsibility is to feed the flock of God, which is among you. Please let that sink in. Which is among you, he says, taking the oversight thereof. This lets us know that each congregation was an independent group with its own members and leadership. And one church never ruled over another church. Elders are officers in the local congregation, and that is the extent of their authority and work. And elders of one congregation did not try to run the affairs of another congregation of which they were not members. And furthermore, each congregation was responsible for its own work. What does that mean? Well, that means, among other things, that one church did not turn over part of its work to the control of another congregation. I would pose this question. If a congregation can turn over part of its work to the control of another congregation, can it turn over all of its work to the control of another congregation? Let me put it like this. Could the church at Janesville, of which I am a member, could we take our treasury and just turn it over to the church here at Columbia and say, "We're going to give you..." Now think about this. This is our treasury. These are our funds. This is the money that we have gathered at Janesville by each of us contributing into the treasury of the church on the first day of the week. Could we take that treasury and just turn it over to this congregation or some other congregation, and we'll just allow you to have control of it? We'll allow you to decide how that money ought to be spent, and so on and so forth. And listen, if we can do that, if we could turn our treasury over to you and let you have all the decision making in regard to our treasury, could we turn over all decision making that we ought to be making as a congregation in regard to evangelism, in regard to the work of the church? We'll just take all of that decision making and turn it over to the church here or to somebody else and allow them to make those decisions for us. Would that be a scriptural system? Well, obviously that would not be scriptural. That would be a violation of congregational autonomy, which of course has to do with the right of self-government. Well, also let me say that in the New Testament times, a congregation did not turn over part of its work to a man-made institution to accomplish work. And listen, if the church is all sufficient to do the work that God assigned it to do, and the congregation is the only functional unit that God put here to do the work that He assigned the church to do, then there is no need, and furthermore, there is no scriptural authority for a middleman organization to stand between the local congregation and its work. And you see, when you boil it all down, that is what is wrong with institutionalism. Now, it can manifest itself in a variety of ways, but I believe that it is always a violation of the very same principle. In the area of evangelism, that is what is wrong with the missionary society. What is the missionary society? Well, this is where congregations send funds to a human organization. You've got these local congregations, as we've already talked about, and they're sending their money, you see, to this middleman organization. And then this human organization decides for the church how that money is going to be spent. They decide which preachers are going to be supported. Maybe they decide, in fact, they do decide what efforts are worthy of support. That's why the missionary society is an unscriptural system, because it's where the church turns over its work and its decision-making, you see, to this man-made organization. Now listen, in the area of benevolence, that is what is wrong with benevolent societies. Now certainly we understand that there are times when needy saints should be relieved. We understand that. We'll talk about that more in a moment. But you know, as we find in Acts 6, verses 1 through 6, it is the church. It is the church that sees the need, that appoints men to see that it is handled right, that makes decisions about how to provide for the need, and so on. And in the New Testament, churches did not build and maintain benevolent societies to do the work that God gave the church to do. So it was not a situation, you see, where we have local congregations that are sending money to some kind of a benevolent society. And this benevolent society probably has a president and a board and a treasury and so on. And this organization, this middleman organization, is receiving funds from the local congregations. And listen, it's this organization that sees the need, that appoints men over it, that provides the support. In other words, this middleman organization is actually doing the work that God assigned that the local church is to do. And that's why it involves an unscriptural system. Well, in the area of edification, now we've talked about evangelism, we've talked about benevolence, let's talk about edification now. That's what's wrong with the church building and maintaining colleges to help the church do the work that God gave the church to do. Yes, obviously, the saints must be edified. But you know what? Never. Never in the New Testament did the church turn over its responsibility in that area to a man-made organization. And again, under this arrangement, you have this middleman organization that's receiving money or funds from local congregations, and then this organization decides how that money is to be spent, and they choose the teachers, they choose the study materials, the curriculum, and so on. They decide who's going to be allowed to be the students. You know, not just everybody can go to just any college. So really it's this middleman organization, the college, the university, if you please, that's making these decisions for the local church. And I want to say this. Now listen, there's an inherent danger. There's an inherent danger in all of this. You know what it is? In many instances, these colleges produce the men who are going to be the preachers and the evangelists that are in the church. In many instances, that will be true. Maybe not in every instance, but in many instances, that's where the preachers and the evangelists are going to come from these so-called church colleges or church universities. But let me ask you this. What if the professors and what if the agenda of those universities is to push modernism, where the authority of the scriptures is undermined? What happens then? I'll tell you what happens then. The result is the pulpits of the church. Think about that. The pulpits of the church are going to be full of preachers who are unsound in the faith and are going to lead the church in different areas into apostasy. And I think surely that demonstrates the wisdom of God's plan for the organization and the work of the church, and it emphasizes why the church should never turn its work and the oversight thereof over to a man-made organization. And so simply put, this is how the church operates and functions. It does so through the local congregation. Now, let me say this. The local church has some responsibilities that only it can fulfill. And I think we need to understand that. I'm talking now about the collective actions assigned the church, bearing in mind that the New Testament presents the local church as the working unit of the body of Christ. And so here's another principle that we need to understand. The New Testament makes a clear distinction between individual action and church action. I'm going to show you the Bible makes that clear distinction. When I'm talking about church action, I'm talking about the collective action of a congregation. Now, unfortunately, there's people sometimes that don't understand the difference. And sometimes people argue like this, and when they do so erroneously. But they say, you know, what the Christian individually can do, the church can do. Because they say, after all, we are the church all the time. The church is the people, is it not? So whatever we can do, that means the church can do, because we act as the church all the time. And so by reasoning that way, they fail to make a distinction between individual action and congregational action. Now, follow me closely. It is true, of course, that we are members of the church at all time, and whatever we do or wherever we go, we conduct ourselves as people who are in the church as far as membership is concerned. That, of course, is true. But that does not mean that everything I do as an individual constitutes congregational action, or that I necessarily do it as an agent of the church. In fact, there are some things that I can do. Now think about this. There are some things that I can do, and there are even some things that I should do as an individual that the church cannot do. And I mean by that, the church cannot do it in a congregational capacity. And likewise, there are certain functions that the Lord has assigned to the local church that are to be fulfilled in a congregational capacity. Now, to prove the point, take a look at what Paul writes in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16. Now these verses are in the area of benevolence. And Paul here is talking about something that is to be done by the individual. Now listen, that the church is not to do. In fact, he's going to say, you do this as an individual if this applies, but the church is not to do this. Now listen to what he says in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16. He says, if any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them. Now listen, and let not the church be charged. There it is. You relieve them, Paul says. The church is not to be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. What is Paul saying? He's saying that if I have widows who are part of my family, perhaps a widowed mother or grandmother, as he suggests in verse 4, and the responsibility falls upon me to support them, then Paul says, I have that obligation to support them, if at all possible. I'm to do that. That's my responsibility as an individual. And he says, I am not to pass that on to the church. In fact, he specifically says, let not the church be charged. Why? He says, that it may be able to support those widows, you see, that have no one to support them. And so here is something that I am to do as an individual that the church is not to do. Now here's the question. What are the collective actions that we've already referred to that have been assigned by the Lord to the local church? Well, when we look at the New Testament, I believe the New Testament shows that the work of the church included and was limited to the following things. First of all, maintaining the worship of God. And of course, that's why we have the assemblies of the local church. You know, in 1 Corinthians 11 there, Paul talks about the local church coming together, and in that chapter specifically, he mentions it several times, when you come together to do what? To eat the Lord's Supper. I said a moment ago, there are certain things that have been assigned to the local church that really can't be fulfilled in an individual capacity. Now listen, brethren, that's why I can't decide this coming Sunday that I'm going to go fishing and I'm going to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, and so I'm going to get out there on the creek bank and I'll just eat the Lord's Supper all by myself as an individual. I can't do that. The Lord's Supper is something, you see, that's been assigned to the local congregation. In other words, it is something that we do when we come together as the church and we eat the Lord's Supper together in a congregational capacity. That's the point I want you to see. And maintaining the worship of God is one of those functions that's been assigned the local church. Another thing, of course, obviously, is evangelism, preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. The third thing is edification of the saints. We are to edify one another. And again, we assemble together for that purpose. A fourth thing that's been assigned the local church is benevolence. And we'll talk about that more in a moment. And then the fifth thing, as far as collective action is concerned, has to do with exercising scriptural discipline whenever such becomes necessary, as we've already talked about in 1 Corinthians 5. Now, this was the area, and let me say, this was the limit of church activity as revealed in the New Testament. That's what the local church involved itself in. Worship, evangelism, edification, benevolence, and scriptural discipline, that's it. That's what the local church was involved in. And may I suggest, before we decide we're going to get off into some other area, like entertainment or something else, we need to get our Bible out and we need to give book, chapter, and verse for that and show where that is an authorized activity for the local congregation. Now, there's two more points that I want to make before I'm through that helps to clarify the topic under consideration. First of all, I want to say this. Either the New Testament limits the work or the activity that a congregation can engage in, or listen, there's absolutely nothing that is off limits. Either the New Testament limits the work of the church, or as we would say, the sky is the limit. And you know what? That's the case in the religious world. As we look about, we see churches engaging in practically everything under the sun. If the work of the church is not limited in any way, then brethren, we can get involved in anything, and I guess some churches are. We can get involved in politics. Some churches do. We can get involved in entertainment. Obviously, some congregations do. We can get involved in building and operating businesses, and there's some churches that do. We can get involved in operating car washes, and on and on and on it goes. If there is no limit as to what a local congregation can do in regard to its work. Now, that's the first point. The second point I want to make is this, that when it comes to benevolence, either the New Testament limits what a congregation can do in that area, or absolutely nothing is off limits. If benevolence is not limited, then that means we can take the funds that we gather, and we can take that money out of the treasury, and we can just spend it in the area of benevolence on anyone for any purpose under the heaven. Now, is that what we believe? Well, obviously, the Bible limits us in the area of benevolence. You know, just to prove the point, should the church give money to a lazy person? If we got a person over here that's so lazy that he won't work and he won't provide for himself and his family, are we as the church obligated to help him out of the treasury of the church? Why, no? How do I know that? Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10 that if a man will not work, neither should he eat. Now, the truth is that in every case of benevolence where the church engaged in helping the needy ones are always spoken of as saints or as brethren. I hope I hit the right button here. There it is. Notice, here's, I believe it's 9 passages right here. Here's all the passages in the New Testament that deals with church benevolence. Now, let me emphasize, we're not talking about what we may do as individuals. You know, as an individual, I can help anyone and everyone as I have an opportunity to do so. But we're talking about church benevolence, what the church, the local congregation, is supposed to do in regard to its treasury and so on in the area of benevolence. And in all of these passages, and I won't go through all of it, but notice, who's involved? All that believe, them that believe, disciples, brethren, the poor saints, the saints, the saints, the saints, widows indeed, here in verse 75. And obviously, those widows indeed were saints. They were children of God. You know what the truth is tonight? The truth is that the Lord never set up His church to be a worldwide benevolent organization. Now, that's the idea of some people's concept of the church. They think that's our mission as the church. We're supposed to feed all the hungry, and we're a worldwide benevolent organization. But the Lord never gave His church that mission. The church is a spiritual kingdom, and its mission has to do with the saving of souls, of course, by the preaching of the gospel. Now, yes, as the church, we take care of our own. And we understand that we have an obligation to help needy saints when the need arises. But the Lord has not commissioned the church to undertake the mission of meeting the physical needs of all humanity. And when the church gets involved in building and maintaining benevolent societies for that purpose, I believe it shows two things. It shows, number one, they really don't understand what the mission of the church is. And secondly, it shows that they lack an understanding of how the church operates and functions. Well, I've got 32 seconds left and counting down. But I want to just say this in conclusion. I hope if you didn't get anything else out of what I said today, that you have been pressed with the idea that the church is the greatest institution upon the face of the earth. There's nothing else like it. In fact, there is no human organization that can even compare to the church. It is a soul-saving institution, and it is all sufficient to carry out the work that God has assigned it to.